Welcome to Face Connecticut, an in-depth look at today's issues.
Good Sunday morning. I'm Matt Dwyer, filling in for Sam Gingerella on News Talk 1080 WTIC, WTIC.com, and WTIC-FM. So with many students headed back to the classroom this week, we'll speak with a person named School Superintendent of the Year a little bit later in the show. Right now, we're joined by Connecticut Association of Public School Superintendents Executive Director Joe Cirasolo. And thank you for coming in, Joe.
Thank you for having me.
So I guess to start off with the kids going back to school, do you have sort of some advice to parents to help kind of transition their students back into the classroom?
My advice would be to have confidence in the schools that their children are going to. I think we have a good record for education in this state, in every district. But also to be vigilant, to make sure that the students are getting what they should be getting, to be supportive of what the school is asking the students to do. But also, if they have any concerns or questions, not to let them fester. Call up, find out what's going on. I think they will find just in every instance that people are willing to work with them, because education is a partnership. It's not just educators. In fact, parents are probably the most important educators of their own children. So be engaged with your child's education, even if they're high school kids and they don't want you to be.
What do you think might be the best way for a parent to sort of support their child as the school year goes on? If it might be sort of, you know, making sure the homework gets done, or sort of modeling some sort of education or learning or reading of their own or something.
Simple
else?
Question every day: what'd you do in school today, and what are you supposed to do when you come home? Many districts, that's a lot easier than it used to be. It doesn't have just to be a conversation between parents and children. In many districts, that stuff is online, and they can access it and find out what the homework assignments are. Help the kids with the homework assignments, encourage them, and encourage the youngsters, if they're having difficulty with something, not to just have difficulty with it, to go get extra help. Do all those things. And I think in a larger sense, always keep before the youngsters the expectation that education is very important. It'll have a major impact on their lives, and keep doing what most parents have done for years. My parents did it for me. Make sure that the kids know that the parents think that education is extremely important.
Any suggestion for parents, maybe of very young children who are maybe going to school the first day, kind of how to sort of ease them into that or prepare them for it? I don't know.
Well, have some Kleenex ready, because when the kids get on the bus, it's going to be a little emotional. I think it's the same advice I would give to parents whose students are starting their last year of high school, except that when the youngsters are younger, the degree of engagement will be a little more intense. And again, if there are any concerns, talk to the schools about them. I think they'll find, especially in the schools that have the youngest children, there'll be a great willingness and eagerness to talk to parents about what the children's experiences are.
So I guess turning to school finances, there was a trial that recently wrapped up in Hartford Superior Court with a coalition of groups, the Connecticut Coalition for Justice and Education Funding, essentially sued the state. And I understand that your organization was part of right. The coalition filing the lawsuit. So essentially, what's the basic sort of argument of the lawsuit here?
Okay. The Supreme Court of the state of Connecticut back in the 1970s said that the state constitution guarantees equitable access to education for every child in the state. And we've been trying to meet that constitutional test ever since. What we're saying in CJEF, though, is that equitable access to an inadequate education doesn't make any sense. And what we're alleging and claiming in court is that the state constitution not only requires requires equitable access, it requires equitable access to an adequate educational program for every kid. That's a very different constitutional test. We think that if we can establish that, it will make certain that every child in this state who goes to a public school, that school, whatever it is, whatever community, whatever type of school, will have the resources it needs to provide that child an adequate education. That's a very important concept. We're very pleased with how the trial went. We obviously will be waiting to see what the judge says now. And then I'm sure that whoever is not successful at the trial level will take it to the appellate level. Eventually, it'll get to the state Supreme Court. We're encouraged by the fact that the state initially in the proceedings claim that adequacy didn't even have to be considered by the trial at the trial level. They were trying to get a declaratory judgment saying this lawsuit has no merit. The state Supreme Court said, yes, you do need to consider it. Doesn't mean they've decided, but they want to have the judges at each level at least look at the issue of adequacy. So that's what that's all about. It's going to take some time. We're looking at a multi-year process here. But we here at CAPS and the other members of the coalition think it's an effort that's worth making.
So down the road, I guess sort of looking beyond the trial, if you're successful, what kind of changes would you envision to the school funding system? I mean, right now, you know, schools are largely funded by sort of local property taxes and also a good deal of money from the state coming through in grants.
Well, it's about 65-35, 65% at the local level, 35% at the state level. That's statewide. It varies community to community. The difference is this. The present system that's on the books, we don't use it all the time, but the present system that's on the books says we will equalize the ability of a community to pay up to a certain percentile rank of communities. I think it's 65th percentile, 70th percentile rank. That has nothing to do with the educational program for children. If we're successful, what the state will have to do is define an adequate educational program. What are the components of it? So much of this, so much of that, so much time, whatever. And then say, okay, for each community, we're going to make sure that the combination of state and local money gives that community the money it needs to provide that program for every child. Very different way to approach funding for education. And if we're successful, our challenge will be to define an adequate educational program.
Do you have any sort of sense as to what sort of a school funding system would look like if your suit is successful? And would there be some sort of like a regional arrangement, or would it all be funded through the state? Or
well, that whether you do it regionally, locally, or statewide is not directly related to whether it's adequate or not. Those are other governance issues that would have to be looked at. I suspect they will be looked at, because once you open up a funding system for consideration of things like adequacy, you're opening it up for everything. There's been a lot of consideration in the state about some regional approaches. I think they will go forward, especially with declining enrollment throughout the state, especially with very small school districts. All of that will happen, but that's going to be happening in parallel conversations to this whole consideration of funding.
So I guess to go from that sort of bigger long-term issue to get down a little bit more narrow, how difficult was the creating school budgets for local boards of education for this school year?
Always very easy. No problem at all. And if you believe that, I'll tell you another story. Look, it's always a challenge because local school boards and superintendents and their staffs have to work out a way to balance the needs of the school system with the willingness and the ability of the community to pay. And that's an ongoing discussion. Usually that starts in October of every year for the next year. Most of the time doesn't end until around May 1st, if you're lucky. Sometimes it goes longer than that, because there has to be a lot of things looked at. So it's always a challenge. Now, it's more of a going to be more of a challenge as we go into the next couple of years, because up until this year, Connecticut was one of four or five states that had not cut funding for education. I like to put it now, we have joined the League of Ordinary States. We got cut this year. All the predictions are we're going to be reduced next year. So that 35% figure I mentioned is going to go down. That's going to make it more difficult. And I don't think we can kid each other. If people say we can't afford it, fine. But let's not say at the same time we're going to have the same program for kids, because we can't print money. Districts really are very good at finding efficiencies where they can and still meet state mandates. If we had some state mandates changed or reduced, we could save more money. There are actually 381 state mandates on school systems in Connecticut. And we have been engaging in an effort to try and help the legislature realize that some of those things need to be addressed if they expect us to be more efficient. Absent that, and with reduction in state money, with not much willingness at the local level to make up for it, over the next 3 to 5 years, the kids are going to get less than they're getting now, and that's a shame.
Are there sort of any ways that you saw in which the cuts that you experienced this year are actually going to play out in the classroom or for the students?
Well, it varies from district to district. The first thing districts do is they try and cut those things that don't have a direct impact on kids. But usually that's in the area of building maintenance, that kind of thing. That's okay for a year or two, but eventually that catches up with you and costs you twice as much 3 years down the road. But that's there. And then they tend to look at extracurricular activities, reduce some of them, eliminate some of them. And then you're getting in, after you've done that, you're getting into the core process. There you're reducing teaching staff. That is increasing class size. All of that's been going on to a certain extent, because even though we haven't had funding reduced, it's been level, while costs have gone up. So in effect, we've had less ability to provide a program. And so we've chronicled this over the last 4 or 5 years, and all those things I've mentioned are happening to more degrees in some districts and less degrees in others. Unfortunately, it looks like it's a trend that will not only continue but be accelerated.
So when the city of Hartford made their budget over the summer, they were expected to eliminate more than 200 jobs, including several dozen teaching positions. It's not all layoffs. A lot of those are simply empty positions that are going to be eliminated. Do they seem to be in kind of the worst financial state in the shape at this point?
Well, they have difficult challenges. I don't want to start comparing districts, who's best, who's worst, whatever. But you just made a very good point. Those positions are eliminated. It doesn't mean necessarily that people lost their jobs, but it means we didn't hire anybody for those vacant positions. Now, unless those 200 people were doing nothing last year, which is not the case, they were providing services for kids. Those services will not be provided in Hartford starting next week. That's exactly what I'm talking about.
I guess elsewhere in Hartford, the city of Hartford was moving to demagnetize, as they put it, the Journalism and Media Academy. And the school officials say under the magnet school requirements, they must have racially integrated classrooms, but there are like too few white and Asian students available. So the children from the neighborhood who want to go to the school are locked out. Do you know of any other communities around the state that are demagnetizing at this point?
That's not a great trend. The reason for the demagnetizing is that to qualify for state money, you need to have a diverse student body. And if you can't attract the diverse student body to a magnet school, you don't get state money for it. You can still do it, but then it gets a lot more expensive. I think what's happening in that situation is relatively unique. I don't see it as a trend across the state.
Okay. And one other thing that you mentioned actually before we started here, that the state Board of Education had called for an increase in mastery-based personal learning. What exactly is that, and what does that mean? Actually, it's part of a five-year plan.
I'll give you the elevator speech on that since we don't have a long time. Basically, it's three things. Right now, as kids go through school, time is the constant. We have them for 13 years. How much they learn varies over that time. We flip that. We make learning the constant and time the variable. So every child gets the time they need to learn what they need to learn. Some kids will do that in 11 years. Some kids will do that in 15 years. So we stop this grouping of kids by how old they are, but instead group them as to where they are on the learning continuum. All by itself, that's a major change, if you think about it, because you don't have grade 1, grade 2, grade 3 anymore. Kids are grouped as to where they are in their learning. That's number one. Number two, we teach kids in a way that's consistent with their primary learning style. The research says there are 6 or 7 different ones of those. We're lucky if we hit 2 of them the way we normally do things. But if we can teach kids in the way that they learn best, they're going to learn a lot more than they learn now. And we have a whole bunch of kids come to us at the age of 5. They've learned a lot in 5 years, but we have a whole bunch of them end up being slow learners and learning disabled, this, that, and the other thing. Now, some of them do have special needs. But for a lot of them, the reason they're having difficulty is how they learn is not how we're teaching. And they've got to learn how to adjust to that. Well, it should be the other way around. We adjust what we do to how they learn. Those are the two major components of mastery-based personalized learning. And there are a number of districts moving in that direction in this state. We're very pleased with that because we advocated for that 4 or 5 years ago, and we see that happening. And we're very happy that the State Board of Education has adopted a master plan that says equity and excellence are important. And they're saying one of the ways to equity and excellence is mastery-based personalized learning. And we're looking forward to working with them to help those districts that are moving in that direction go there and to encourage other districts to do it as well.
So does that sort of play out in the classroom as a bunch of different kids of different ages all in the same classroom?
Could be. Actually, you're not going to have, when it's in its fully blown version, the classroom will not remain static the whole day. For English, for different things, there will be different kids grouped together. Some schools, there are already schools in this country and even some in this state that have broken down the walls. So you got larger group, larger areas for kids to move around in. It's a very different way. It's very much a learning center. And I think with technology, it's going to become a website-based approach. That doesn't mean we put a kid in front of a computer and walk away. That's not personalized learning. That's as bad as giving lecturing to them all day. But technology enables us to identify where the kids are at, provide a program for them, group them with different kids at different times, help them learn even in places outside the school building, because learning should be taking place anytime, anywhere. Gets ourselves out of the traditional school day. Now, not all learning takes place between 9 and 3. And not all learning takes place between September and June. So we can be a lot more flexible with the school year, the school day, and how we group kids. So it's very exciting. The districts are moving that direction, are excited about it. They need to be careful. They need to be thoughtful. But I think it's going to happen.
And is this something that the State Board of Education is setting as a requirement or a suggestion, or are there any carrots or sticks associated with?
The best way to kill this is make it a requirement, because then everybody will have to do it the same way and it doesn't work. What they have said is they're going to encourage districts. Now, I'm sure they're going to be thinking about some incentives. The chairperson of the State Board at the back-to-school meeting the other day said something very important. He said the State Board will look at things that are in place now that are barriers to, and our present graduation requirements, by the way, are barriers to personalized learning. They'll be very willing to remove those barriers so districts can move in that direction.
We've been speaking with Connecticut Association of Public School Superintendents Executive Director Joseph Ciricillo. Thank you for joining us. Westport Superintendent of Schools Colleen Palmer was named Superintendent of the Year by the Connecticut Association of Public School Superintendents. I spoke with her at a gathering of superintendents in Hartford.
I think funding schools will be a challenge for the future, as it has been in the past, especially as the state has had dramatic cuts in the educational cost sharing to many communities. The current district in which I serve as superintendent in Westport had approximately $1.1 million reduced from its budget. And as this group of superintendents discusses the future, we all are very concerned about the rest of the ECS money being taken away from schools as the state grapples with its fiscal problems.
I imagine that some people in other parts of the state might assume, oh gosh, Westport, you know, they must have all the resources they need. Is the reality quite not that rosy?
I think that when education lies on the individual taxpayer and the homeowner in terms of property taxes, it's a difficult equation. And to have a substantial amount of money yanked out of a community abruptly creates a disequilibrium for that community. So Westport has been able to have funding from the state over $2 million a year. And if all of that were taken away suddenly, I think the community would ask the school district, as it already has for the first pass, to look at ourselves critically and to say, how can we have cost efficiencies? There is no bottomless pit of money for any community.
And so a little bit more broadly, I know folks obviously realize that I'm sure a superintendent is the boss of the schools, but what exactly is your relationship with the Board of Education and the staff?
I serve as a CEO, so to speak, for the district, but I serve the Board of Education, who really is the oversight of the district. And as I begin my new relationship with my new board, I have begun to work collaboratively with our board members. I need to understand what their vision is for the district, and my job is to contribute to that vision formation and then to actualize that vision through the staff and the community partnerships that are essential to any school district.
As you work with a new Board of Education at the start of the year or new folks coming on a board, are there certain kind of things that sometimes you sort of have to teach them about or kind of bring them up to speed on, or certain things that sort of come up year after year that sort of people just have to realize as they come into that job on a Board of Education?
I think there's always a learning curve when anyone starts a new board position, whether it's the Board of Education, it's a private board or another public board, to understand the role and the responsibilities and to really then get down into the level of granularity of understanding the work. So I think it's a natural learning curve, and I think my job is to assist any new board member to kind of jumpstart that process so they feel comfortable in making good decisions.
So sometimes in my job as a reporter, when I'm going to a Board of Education meeting, it sometimes means that somebody on the board has come up with some sort of a hot-button issue that's somehow drawn a lot of attention. Can sometimes those sorts of things kind of get a little bit in the way of some of the basic sort of educational issues? If certain hot-button issues are kind of brought in that maybe kind of divide a board politically? Or...
Well, I think there's nothing that is going to be more emotionally charged than how we take care of our students, because they are the sons and daughters of caring parents. And so when we think about how important the decisions we are, I think it's natural it's going to be emotionally charged. Can we have diverse ideas? Yes. I think it's part of my role to facilitate conversation so we can find out what might be the most appropriate pathway to reach the goals we're hoping to achieve. How do we do it effectively? How do we do it efficiently? How do we do it collaboratively? So I think regular discourse on various ideas is a normal part of healthy conversation of boards. I think taking that discourse and moving it forward in actionable, productive items is the work of the superintendent with the board.
And do you have a certain philosophy or sort of words of wisdom that kind of help you as you go through your job and get the deal with the things that maybe keep you up at night, that sort of thing?
Words of wisdom, I think it's all about relationships. I think it's important to forge strong relationships with all the stakeholder groups in the community to understand their point of view, to understand the point of view of your parents, of your families, of the leaders of the town, and this is besides, obviously, the Board of Ed, and then your internal stakeholders, your teachers, your paraprofessionals, your maintenance crew, the frontline secretaries. You really need to understand what is the perspective of every stakeholder, because if you can understand where they're coming from, you can make more informed decisions.
Okay, and do you have you mentioned parents in there, too. Do you have any advice for parents as we're going back to school right about now?
Oh, I just want to say to parents that there are tens of thousands of educators across the state who have been working all summer eagerly preparing classrooms, and we are thrilled. We are so excited that the school buses are going to roll, and I encourage parents not to be reticent. If there is any concern, they should reach out to the teachers, to the principals. They should reach out and make a connection with the school, because we are all in this together, and if we don't know from their perspective, if there's an issue, we can't address it.
So if you had the power to make any one change in the school systems across the state, what might it be?
I have a magic wand to change one thing. I think I would love to have an opportunity for students and professionals across the state to have more ease of sharing of great ideas and collaborative work. I think together we're all stronger.
That was Colleen Palmer, Westport Superintendent of Schools. I'm Matt Dwyer, filling in for Sam Gingerella. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday.
Face Connecticut is a production of the News and Public Affairs Department of WTIC Radio.